Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For the past decade, Voices of Witness has amplified the voices of hundreds of people impacted by some of the most crucial human rights violations of our time through its oral history book series. Their 14 books include Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation, Invisible Hands, Voices from the Global Economy, High Rise Stories, Voices from Chicago Public Housing, and Inside This Place, Not Of It, Narratives from Women's Prisons. The renowned oral historian Studs Terkel once said, quote, "People are hungry for stories. It's part of our very being. Storytelling is a form of history, of immortality. It goes from one generation to another," end quote. To mark a decade of inspiring storytelling, Voices of Witness co-founder Dave Eggers has edited narratives from their many volumes to create a compilation titled The Voice of Witness Reader, 10 Years of Amplifying Unheard Voices. So on today's Your Call, we are spending the hour talking about the power of oral histories and storytelling. How can hearing the voices of the people affected by injustice change the way we understand and defend human rights? Today, I'm joined by Mimi Locke, an award-winning writer and arts educator. Mimi is co-founder and executive director of Voice of Witness, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Mimi. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Cliff Mayotte is the education program director of Voice of Witness, and Cliff also joins me in studio. Hi, Cliff. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. And Peter Orner is editor of Voice of Witness, a writer and professor of creative writing at San Francisco State. Peter is currently working on a Voice of Witness book about post-earthquake Haiti, and he joins us on the line. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us, and thanks to all of you, and congratulations. I love your book series. You do such an amazing job of really giving people a voice and letting them tell their own story in their own words. And Mimi, let's start off with you. It seems like there is just a craving right now for oral history and storytelling.
I think that's true. I think storytelling has been, along with the word empathy, it's been kind of like a buzzword for a while. You know, every few years or so, you see people using that word storytelling for social change or empathy. But I think now more than ever, it's true. And I think you see that in lots of different sectors, lots of different realms. But for us, we're seeing it in the education work that we do. And we also see it in the number of people who are writing to us now with ideas for book projects. So there's a hunger to hear these stories. There's a hunger to tell these stories as well.
And Cliff, what do you think explains that? Before the show, we were just talking about all of the noise that we are bombarded with on a regular basis. And there's something nice about getting away from it and reading something that can be pretty intense, but reading something that you might not hear in the noise, a story that's told by someone in their own words.
Yeah, and as you're saying, I think there's people are really have a hunger for that authentic storytelling experience. And you could read one of the stories from the Voice of Witness book series and feel as though you're not being lectured at or preached at, or that it's not an essay. It's someone's telling you a story, and it's a very personal. You can create a lot of personal connections that way, and really find your way into stories that maybe you didn't think you could connect with. And a lot of the students and teachers that we work with around the country are finding incredible moments of connection from people from all around the world.
Because you find that this really resonates with students. And in your book, you all write that in 2014, the education program served over 12,000 students and teachers through class visits, workshops, trainings, and through curriculum that's been created for each book.
Yeah, and I think one of the major impacts and takeaways, what we're noticing, is that teachers and students start to see themselves as participants in history and not bystanders, both by reading some of the books and reading some of the stories in the book series, but also through a lot of the support that we give to teachers and classrooms to conduct their own oral history projects. And so that they get to see, students are seeing that their own stories matter, and their family stories matter, and their community stories matter. As opposed to being, you know, something that they felt a disconnect with. They're feeling a connection to history and feeling like they're participants in it, which is a really powerful powerful way of teaching and learning.
And Peter, you're currently working on your third Voice of Witness book. You're going to focus on post-earthquake Haiti. And from your perspective, since you're out in the field actually interviewing people, just to let people know, this is a very time-consuming process. So for example, and we'll talk about this later, but the book Palestine Speaks took editors 4 years to complete, involved 250 hours of interviews and 3 months of fact-checking. So a lot of work goes into these books. Why are they so powerful for you? And why are you, you know, why do you take part in this series? Why are you working on a third book?
I'm listening to you talk about how long Palestine Speaks took. That sounds about right. That's really what these books take. We don't do this lightly, and we take our time because we're not chasing a news story. We're chasing something considerably deeper. And so for me, as a fiction writer, it's incredibly exciting to spend this kind of time with people one-on-one, face-to-face, talking to them about their most personal stories. And because we take it so seriously, and because it's so we're so honored that people are allowing us into their lives like this, it takes a lot of time. But that's part of the joy of it for me, is that while we do have deadlines and sometimes I'm not able to meet them, the fact that we take our time and go about this in a methodical way, for me, is actually one of the greatest things about it, is that I'm allowed the freedom to spend hours with people talking to them.
And how did you come up with the idea of giving a voice to people who are living in Haiti? And once you get this idea accepted, where do you begin?
Well, you know, Haiti, as you know, was the earthquake in 2010 was about as devastating an event as in recent memory. More than 300,000 people were killed on January 12th, 2010. And for me, and this has happened in a lot of the other books as well. Often, it's the news coverage of a particular event that gets me going. And, you know, we covered Haiti incredibly tightly at that time in 2010 in the aftermath. But how much is Haiti in the news now? And it needs to be. And people mm-hmm. need to understand what has happened in not only the five years since the earthquake, but what happened before those 5 years that resulted in the devastation that the earthquake caused, because it was a largely man-made crisis because of the substandard housing and overcrowded conditions in the capital city, Port-au-Prince. So for me especially, I'm trying to get underneath the glossy news story and find out what people are doing to actually survive on the ground, which is what our book's about.
And you have been quoted as saying that people you have interviewed have told you, in some variation of the same sentiment, you know, nobody, even members of my own family, has ever asked me these sorts of questions. It's a way of connecting to people across countries, cultures, languages. It brings people together in ways that aren't too common.
Right. I think that, you know, that holds true in the Haiti book, and I've done a book on undocumented people living in America. And that's where that quote essentially came from, is that, and here we are, in that, the Underground America book, which is about undocumented immigrants living in the U.S., grew out of the 2008 kind of what I saw as almost an hysteria, an anti-immigrant hysteria that resulted around the possible passage of an immigration reform bill. We're now in 2015, and look at the, you know, here it is again. This anti-immigration hysteria, and what I was trying to do there was, again, try and get under the story by very simply asking the people that were most directly affected by what people were talking about in the news.
Right,
what I hadn't seen on Lou Dobbs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was thinking it's even worse this time around.
It may well be. It may well be.
So can you talk, though, a little bit more about the process involved? Because I love the beginning of the Voices of Witness reader, 10 years of amplifying unheard voices. I mean, you basically talk about what goes on behind the scenes. So, for example, a human is more than his or her trauma. To change minds, we need to complicate thinking. It takes as long as it takes, the interview process. It could take maybe a full day. It could take months before you really can get a feel of where people are coming from or what they're feeling. You also say that we honor their stories by making them right. So as someone who's done a lot of interviewing, talk a little bit about that and just the, you know, the process involved.
Well, as you can imagine, and Mimi and Cliff can definitely speak to this too, because they've done a great deal of work in this area too, is that the key thing is trust. And the fact is that we are not, you know, drive-by interviewers. We are actually getting involved in people's lives in over the long term to have genuinely real conversations with people and about very, very hard things. And what I have found is that by only focusing on human rights violations, for example, in an interview, that only tells a tiny segment of the story of someone's life. So I think what Voice of Witness does particularly well, and why I'm really honored to be working with this organization, is that it's not all about the extreme human rights violations that we are trying to illuminate as part of our goals, but also to give a reader a sense of who people are way beyond just the horrible thing that's happened to them.
And Mimi, you are co-founder and executive director of Voice of Witness, and you started as one of Underground America's interviewers.
That's right.
And so talk about that project and how you got involved.
Well, I actually used to work with Peter on the MFA creative writing program at San Francisco State. And about a year after I graduated, actually when I was thinking of leaving the country and going back to England or Hong Kong, which is where I'm from, Peter reached out and told me about a project he was working on undocumented workers in the US, and asked if I'd want to be involved in this sort of a team of interviews and research that he was putting together. And my parents are immigrants, they're Chinese immigrants, but you know, they moved to the UK, and I was really, really interested. And so I spent close to a year, Peter, working on the book. And it was just, and I come from, well, one of my backgrounds is in journalism and in teaching and in writing, and this just was a really unique nexus of those different forms of storytelling and inquiry. So as a journalist, when I was working in Hong Kong, I always regretted not having more time with people, as Peter touched on. And then with the approach that we were taking with these stories for Underground America, it felt luxurious to sit down with people and actually spend hours and hours talking with them and following up, building relationships over the course of months, maybe years, but also applying the same sense of journalistic integrity and, you know, the fact-checking, the research, and the accountability, I think. And that's one thing that I'm very proud of that we do at Voice of Witness, is that we really prioritize the narrator's agency. That's inherent in the term that we use to describe people who share their stories with us. We call them narrators rather than interview subjects or interviewees, because they are narrating their own story. And so one of the steps that we take is offering the transcript, the first draft, second draft, final draft for the narrator's review and approval before we print anything, because I have to be happy with the job that we've done of portraying their story.
And in some cases, they've said, I'd like to make some changes. But they've also said, thank you for actually bringing this to me, because this is the first time anyone has ever said, this is what's going to be printed. And in some cases, it's the first time anyone who's interviewed them has checked back in with them.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And so, you know, this goes back to the drive-by interviewing that Peter referred to. And it's, I think a lot of journalists probably do wish that they could go back and check in and, you know, and follow up, but it's just, you know, the nature of the way news is produced and digested and then discarded, is it doesn't really create conditions for that kind of depth, I think.
And Cliff, how did you get involved with Voice of Witness?
I got involved with Voice of Witness in 2010, and the idea was to start an education program. And there had been, before I had joined Voice of Witness, members of the organization had reached out to a couple of local teachers, and they had developed lesson plans for a few of the books in the series, but that was kind of all that had happened up to that point. And there was a real desire and a real yearning to create a full-scale education program that created curriculum for all the books in the series, as well as creating curriculum and opportunities and experiences for teachers and students to engage in the process that Peter and Mimi are talking about, everything from the compassionate communication and ethical considerations and the idea that the world for students gets a lot bigger when you're reading stories like this and having their thinking complicated. So I have a background in teaching as well, and so I'd been a full-time classroom teacher here in the Bay Area for about 15 years before joining Voice of Witness. And a lot of my background and skill set was through performance, and oral history is performance, you know, in the work of Anna Deavere Smith and others, and also teaching literature and journalism. And all three of those things really converged for the work that I feel very fortunate to do with Voice of Witness.
Dave Eggers, in the introduction of The Voice of Witness Reader, 10 Years of Amplifying Unheard Voices, talks about the 12 years he spent working with high school students through 826 National's network of writing and tutoring centers. And he talks about the War on Terror and how these kids have heard this phrase since the third grade, War on Terror, War on Terror. And they really kind of lost it lost its meaning because it's been repeated so much. But that all changed when they read the book Patriot Acts by Alia Malik. She's also been on this show. And she interviewed a number of people who've been swept up in this war on terror in the United States. And the students' perspective on it completely changed after reading those stories.
Absolutely. It's, you know, as we talked about, you know, a lot of these phrases, you know, the war on terror, they don't have any meaning anymore. And in the age of the soundbite, and you know, students might be studying, you know, civil rights issue or social justice issue, and by reading the personal narrative of somebody who's actually experiencing this quote unquote, you know, war on terror, they have their thinking complicated in very useful ways because they might be learning about terrorism or the war on terror, but they have a very specific opinion, you know, based on what they've heard. And when they get to experience the stories firsthand, they're able to say to themselves, gosh, I thought I kind of had a handle on this thing about terror and terrorism, and now I don't know what to think.
Right.
And so it becomes very, their thinking becomes very complicated in a useful way. And it saves space and opens up opportunities for nuance and complexity and detail that they normally aren't experiencing in a lot of their curriculum.
And reading about a family whose home was broken into one night by a team of FBI and Homeland Security agents in Brooklyn, the father was handcuffed. They were brought to a detention center in Manhattan, held for 6.5 weeks without charges. That really resonated with these students.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator of that story, Adam Abbas, she was 16 at the time, mm-hmm. and she was hauled off to a detention center on suspicion of being a suicide bomber. And it was only when actually a journalist found out what was, and she was being held there without charges, and so in really terrible conditions. It was only when a journalist started getting wind of what was going on that they released her, but with still no charges, but she had to wear an ankle bracelet. And I think she was on a no-fly list for several years after, and you know, no charges were ever brought against her, and it was just really incredible. And I think one of the reasons why the students who read Adama's story really connect with her is that she's a 16-year-old. She talks like a 16-year-old. I think they could really see themselves in her. I think they were surprised that there was that connection, and also horrified that this kind of thing was happening to American citizens in their own country.
And again, that Voice of Witness book is called Patriot Acts, and it was edited by Alia Malik. And today we are talking about the Voice of Witness series with Mimi Locke, co-founder and executive director of Voice of Witness. Cliff Mayotte is education program director with Voice of Witness, and Peter Orner is editor, and he's currently working on a Voice of Witness book about post-earthquake Haiti. And so if you've ever read a Studs Terkel book, the Voice of Witness books are very similar. They've got 14 out so far. They are celebrating 10 years, a number of really incredible books. They include Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation, Invisible Hands, Voices from the Global Economy, High-Rise Stories, Voices from Chicago Public Housing, and you can find their series of books at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about oral history and storytelling? It seems like there is such a craving for this kind of, well, storytelling, these kinds of books, a lot of radio. We're getting a lot of this now. So how are you affected by storytelling and this specific kind? How can hearing the voices of people affected by injustice change the way you understand and defend human rights? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Mimi, as you said, you have a very small staff, mm-hmm. and you're getting so many more book proposals, mm-hmm. because I think this is just getting a lot more publicity now. What is the market out there for something like this?
That's a really good question. Well, I think I can respond to that by talking about what we know to be our readers and our audiences. And it's pretty diverse. It kind of runs the gamut from a middle school student to policymaker and everyone you can imagine in between. So in terms of, I think that the education sector makes up a pretty considerable chunk of our readership and our audience, and that, and when we talk about the education audience, that's from middle school through to college, university level. And then there are folks who represent communities that are directly invested in and impacted by the issues that are portrayed in the series. So they might be advocates, they might be attorneys, people working in community grassroots organizations, professors looking for material for their courses that actually attempt to put a human face on and I think sort of animate a different kind of connection to the subject that they're teaching in, for their students. And then also increasingly we're looking at partnerships with organizations that have the means to reach a broader audience than we can. So so these might be advocacy organizations, they might be human rights organizations, but the challenge always has been is that we're a small nonprofit and that we have to fundraise for every book that we produce. And so something that we're actually trying to, that we've actually conceived this summer is a new initiative called the Vow Fellowship Fund, where we're trying to actually fundraise for a dedicated pot of funding so that we can actually incubate more projects. Mm. Each year we can only take on like one or two new book projects, but we're hoping to create this fellowship fund so that we can have this pot of funding up front and we can say yes to many more projects, but That's always a challenge, as you know.
Right. Cliff, what would you add to that?
Well, I think Mimi really touched on the broad range of our audience from middle school students through policymakers. And I think with a lot of the folks that we work with through our education program, a lot of the teachers who participate in our trainings and workshops, we have this sort of train the trainer method because we want as many people to be sharing as many stories as possible in their classrooms and communities. And so another part of our audience are the teachers who talk about the trainings and the workshops that they've received through Voice of Witness. And they go back and they're able to share that with, you know, the 100 students that they work with. And they tell another teacher about it. And they share a Voice of Witness book with another teacher. And that educator signs up for one of our trainings. And so that's a real large part of our audience as well. And it's really growing and gaining traction.
Today we are talking about Voice of Witness. This is a project that amplifies the voices of hundreds of people impacted by human rights violations through its oral history book series. They've got 14 books, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. If you're an educator who has taught one of the Voice of Witness books, we'd love to hear from you. How did students interact? How did they respond? And then overall, what are your thoughts on the power of storytelling? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar on the phone or by sending an email. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can address your email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. www.worldhaveyoursay.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Then at noon today, it's Backstory. Following that at 1, Alternative Radio. And then at 2, a full hour of headlines and analysis from the BBC on NewsHour here on Local Public Radio, KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with award-winning documentarian Hubert Sauper about his latest film, We Come as Friends. Sauper traveled to Sudan to document the birth of South Sudan, which declared its independence in 2011. The film takes an in-depth look at the effects of colonialism, globalization, and corruption, and why South Sudan has been mired in a perpetual state of war. And speaking of Sudan, actually, Voice of Witness has a book called Out of Exile: The Abducted and Displaced People of Sudan. And today we are talking about Voice of Witness as they celebrate their 10th year. This is an organization that amplifies the voices of people impacted by human rights violations through its oral history book series. They've got 14 incredible books out: Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives, Nowhere to Be Home, Narratives from Survivors of Burma's Military Regime. I mentioned the Patriot Acts book earlier, Inside This Place, Not Of It, Narratives from Women's Prison, Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. And we're joined today by Mimi Locke. She is co-founder and executive director of Voice of Witness. Cliff Mayott is education program director of Voice of Witness. And Peter Orner is currently working on his third book on post-earthquake Haiti. He's editor of Voice of Witness. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the power of storytelling and hearing people tell their own stories in their own words? If you're a fan of Studs Terkel, you will definitely be a fan of Voice of Witness. And if you're an educator who has brought in Voice of Witness or maybe other books, how have your students responded to reading people's stories told in their own words? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And in this noise machine that we're all part of and all trying to kind of figure out how to deal with it, what are your thoughts on just sort of stepping back and reading oral histories? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And speaking of education, I understand, Cliff, that you have an exciting program that you're launching today called the Sharing History Initiative.
Yes, today is the official launch, and it's an opportunity that we have through some funding that we received through the Abundance Foundation and the Isabel Allende Foundation to place 1,500 copies of The Reader, of our new anthology that we've been talking about, in 50 schools around the country. And it's an opportunity for us to grow our network of teachers and learners, expose more people to the stories in the book series, create more opportunities for teachers to download our free downloadable curriculum from our website, and just create a larger learning community.
That's great.
Using these stories as a foundation.
And so for educators, where can they find information about this?
They can find information about the Sharing History Initiative on our website. There's a Sharing History page on voiceofwitness.org. You could also email us at edu@voiceofwitness.org. And we'd be happy to share more information about it and to have people apply online.
And we talked earlier about how students were affected by the Patriot Acts book. Do you have any other stories that stand out for you?
Well, I think there's the way students are responding to stories. And also, I just wanted to share a story from a student that engaged with Voice of Witness and engaged in an oral history project at her school, a young woman named Pravina, who at the time was a student at Mission San Jose High School in Fremont. And through engaging in oral history and listening to stories of people that she didn't know very much about, whether it was the kid that sat next to her in class or even her teacher, she started to see the culture of her room, the culture of her English class, totally change. And it became a culture and a climate where students saw each other. You know, it's like you share a story with someone and you have an opportunity to say, well, who do you see now? I occur to you a little bit differently than I did before we had this conversation, or before we had a chance to interview each other, or before we had a chance to interview the teacher or somebody else on our campus or somebody else from our community. So those stories of how this kind of oral history process and this kind of story sharing has had an impact on the culture of a school, you know, starting with one student and then, you know, rippling out from there.
And Peter, do you have any stories? You're now working again on your third Voice of Witness book on post-earthquake Haiti.
Sure. I, My first book that I did in the series was Underground America, about undocumented people living in the U.S. And in going around the country for that book, the response was pretty overwhelming, especially at the time, as I talked about earlier, that immigration was so in the news. And what was most gratifying, actually, was when I would give a talk about the book and people would disagree with me, would actually engage, or disagree with my personal perspective, which I try to keep out as much as I can, although it's difficult sometimes, given that I spent so much time with people. So demonizing them and talking about them in cliche ways would obviously, I obviously would disagree with that approach. But I can say that one of the most gratifying things about Underground America in particular was undocumented students who would approach me after readings and talks, because I think they felt that finally, and we're not the only book that has out there in the world that gives voice to undocumented people, but I think our approach particularly resonated because in the book we interview and we have narrators who are undocumented students, and they spoke directly to that experience, to, for example, not be able to go on a school trip because, the high school girl in our book didn't have a social security number to get on a plane, et cetera, et cetera. Just, little things like that that are so, that we take for granted, and I think that it really resonated with not just the people who may have not thought about this issue before and how it affects people on a day-to-day level, but also that other undocumented people felt heard because of reading other stories of people like them in the book.
And in the case of, undocumented immigrants, do you think that kind of empathy can lead to real change?
I have to, otherwise I wouldn't get up in the morning. But I think, as Mimi said, I think sometimes the empathy word sort of gets overused. I think that what I think was so powerful about the voices in Underground America in particular was that how ordinary and how every day, where we talk to people who just simply work hard like most Americans, frankly. And what I think really touched a nerve in that book was not that these voices were asking for any particular empathy. They were asking to be treated like Americans that they are, and that to me was more powerful than sort of generating a kind of sympathy. Mm. But yes, I believe that if we start to understand people's stories and take them seriously as individual human stories, yes, of course, I think that's the only way we're going to have change. But the voices of stereotyping are awfully loud.
Right.
We don't speak nearly as loud as that.
Right. Well, maybe if the media gave a voice to some of these people you interviewed, things could possibly change that, right?
Absolutely. And let me just say one other thing, is that when we do presentations for all our books, we have narrators from the books participate in the discussion. The tricky thing with Underground America was that technically we have people breaking the law, so that oftentimes we'd have to change names and people would appear on Skype on a screen. But sometimes, and on rare occasions and beautiful occasions actually, people would appear in person and say, "Here I am. Huh. I'm an undocumented person. I gave my voice to this book. Ask me anything you want." Huh. And those were particularly powerful moments, and we still do that.
Mm. I can think of similar story in terms of just response from individuals and from a community that had felt previously unheard, and that was through our book High Ride Stories, Voices from Chicago Public Housing, and that was compiled and edited by Audrey Petty, who's from Chicago, grew up on the South Side, and she herself, in her introduction to the book, Frida admits that until she saw the high rises come down, it didn't occur to her to ask the question, well, where did these people go, and what were their lives like? And so this started this, I think, 3 or 4 year inquiry. And I think when we launched the book in Chicago, the turnout at each event that we did was just incredible. It's packed to the rafters, and people from public housing and teachers and local advocates and it was just incredible. And the one thing that we kept hearing was finally someone is actually talking about this, and we, you know, it was a really powerful way to connect with this community that was on the other side of our immediate surroundings and our immediate environment, and now we have such a we actually have pretty much a second education network, like a satellite community in Chicago, because Cliff and Claire go back there like several times a year to run workshops, and the book just continues to resonate within Chicago's communities.
Well, and I was wondering, do you keep in touch with some of these people? Because in that book about Chicago's public housing project, Donnell is interviewed. He was initiated into gang life at the age of 12. Sabrina was interviewed. Her sister was shot in the head in their Cabrini Green apartment when she was caught in the middle of a turf-related shooting. And then Dolores, who at the age of 82 was displaced from her home after 53 years and forced to leave many of her belongings. Do the interviewers keep in touch with the people they meet and get, you know, talk to over the year?
Yes, definitely. And I think it varies a bit from book to book, but using High-Rise Stories as an example, I think Audrey has been very adept at maintaining relationships with the narrators from that particular book. And a couple of the narrators you mentioned, Dolores Wilson and Sabrina Nixon, are some of the narrators that are always participating in Chicago events around High-Rise Stories or around oral history or anything around Chicago public housing. And she's been in touch with a lot of them and maintains contact and is always inviting them to do, various events around Chicago.
And Peter, you stayed in touch with a lot of your narrators from past books as well, haven't you?
Right, and I can say, you know, that one of the things that makes this unique, this whole experience unique, is that the stories are really collaboration between interviewer and narrator, and that, you know, that so you know, we build these stories together. And for example, in Haiti right now, the lead interviewer on the book is actually not myself. The lead interviewer is a Haitian journalist on the ground who is under working very closely with me and doing all kinds of amazing day-to-day interviews, and oftentimes with people he knows personally. So, we're sort of, each book, I think, the model sort of evolves and changes. So I think we're almost getting, with the Haiti book in particular, we're trying to make it even more homegrown than the other books. But I can say, you know, having worked on the Underground America and also Hope Deferred, the book about Zimbabwe, is that to this day, you know, I'm always in email contact with people. People always know where to find me. And you know, I get updates. And for this new, for the new reader that recently came out, we got in touch with as many people as we could. Obviously, some people fade away, and you lose contact with because of the nature of the lives of many of the people. For example, in Zimbabwe, many of my interviews were conducted on the border of Zimbabwe and South Africa when Zimbabweans were fleeing political violence. So, you know, some people we aren't able to keep in touch with, but we do our very best, and I have some very, very close friendships from all the books to this day.
That is Peter Orner. He's working on his third Voice of Witness book on post-earthquake Haiti. Cliff Mayotte is Education Program Director with Voice of Witness, and Mimi Locke is co-founder of Voice of Witness. It's a project that amplifies the voices of hundreds of people impacted by human rights violations through its oral history book series. They've got 14 books out, and they are celebrating a decade of really amplifying these voices. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the power of oral history, storytelling, bringing these books into the classroom? You can find, again, if you're an educator, you can get free books. Find more information at voiceofwitness.org. And let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much. I am so impressed by the work you all are doing, and bravo, brava. And as it's oral history, I'm wondering what you're doing about presenting it in an oral way through electronic media. I've been an educator for 50 years in many different venues, and I have found that a 3-minute film that we did on washing your hands and keeping communicable diseases away, etc., is our biggest seller. That's half of our royalty check every quarter. And I know I'm thinking about little small, like 30-second grabs of your interviews that would be distributed mobile, in a mobile way. I'm struck a little bit by the ignorance, and I don't mean that in a negative way, they just don't have knowledge of young people who are out of school and have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world, none whatsoever. Don't know about the genocide, don't know about the wars. And hearing a story in your ear, man, I think it would be just so powerful. Are you doing that?
Yes, in brief, all our books are available as ebooks, but to your point, we totally recognize the short attention span of this generation, and actually the generation before that, I think now. But also how it can be tricky sometimes to engage people who have never really thought of or engaged with an issue that might be happening on the other side of the country or the other side of the world. And so the human story is one obvious way for us to provide that entry point. And the other way is the presentation of that human story. So we do create short, simple multimedia pieces that that provide a sort of little, you know, accessible access point to the work. And we're trying to do that more and more and partnering with folks who have more of that capacity. So so we've done we have a multimedia education piece that we've been developing with Magnum Foundation based on our Columbia book, and we do audio slideshows and things like that. These are things that we, you know, we're a tiny organization, so we'd love to spend all day working on these things. But so the ambition is to do more of these, just to, you know, get more folks to hear about the work and to engage with it, because it can be a little bit daunting to just, you know, pick up an entire book on X, Y, and Z human rights topic. But I think once you even get a few seconds or a few sentences of someone's story, you want to hear more. You want to learn more.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruby. Let's go next to Ben in Pleasanton. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to call and say hi and say that I'm a really big admirer of Voice of Witness. I think it's a great program. I just finished reading Inside This Place, Not Of It, and it's just full of, like, really powerful stories. And it just, I really love how your organization is so, it's collaborative. It's a collaborative process, and it's just very admiring for me. I'm also really inspired by the educational program that you have in place. I just think it's great. I don't know what to say. It's really great. I myself have been pretty involved in working with at-risk populations or just in bad situations, ranging from refugees, juvenile hall, foster care, group homes, or just poor communities, mostly with youth. But it hasn't been, and it's been like mostly one-on-one, so it really, I've been hearing very, very intimate and personal stories. But it, you know, that's not like a program where it's being heard by people all over. So I just really appreciate the way that Voice of Witness is produced and really getting those stories out in a respectful way. It's not, you know, just if it leads, it leads journalism. It's you know, it's something that has taken a long time, and it's really compassionate, and it just, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Okay. And thank you for the listening that you do in your work. We talk a lot about amplifying unheard voices, and we can amplify them, but if there's nobody on the other end to listen, then it's, you know, that's tricky. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you for calling in, Ben. Mimi, you said that you have been bombarded with proposals. What are you getting right now? What's kind of catching your eye?
Well, I'm not sure whether I
can talk about
say it right now, but I can say that.
Is there a theme?
I can I can say what projects that we're interested in exploring further and having further discussions about. We're looking at a proposal on solitary confinement, which I think could be a great continuation of our work. Amplifying voices from the criminal justice system, from the prison system. I think that's an area that we will keep going back to time and again, and approaching from different angles. And we're always interested in projects that touch upon issues of immigration and labor just internally, Cliff and I and Claire, our education program associate, on our internal wish list is a project that addresses the school to prison pathways. Mm-hmm. And it's just finding the right people for it who have time to commit to a project to do that. So if anyone out there is working in this field and has a strong idea for a book project on the school to prison pathways, then please get in touch with us. That's an official solicitation for a proposal.
Yeah, well, when you think about solitary, just raising the voices of people who've been in solitary, or like Khalif Browder, I brought him up a bunch on the show, on the series we did on prisons last week. The young man who allegedly stole a backpack, his mom couldn't pay $3,000 in bond. He went to Rikers, 800 days in solitary, and never had a trial. He was released. 2 years to the day he was released, he committed suicide. The New Yorker, thanks to The New Yorker, they gave him a voice, and then every other media outlet followed. And immediately we saw a change in legislation and a lot of awareness raising about who spends time in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. And the ACLU has been doing incredible work in this area as well. And I know that I can't speak for that organization, but I do notice that stories are core to any meaningful work that's done in changing policy around this very disturbing part of our culture. I mean, that, you know, that's there's no other way to put it. It is part of our culture, and so that's an area that's a subject that we're definitely interested in exploring, and also just the unique perspective that I think that you'd get from someone who spends most of the time in isolation, and just seeing what their perception of their own story is after, you know, given several months or several years or several decades in solitary. You know, something that I think is a really important part of our work is how one's relationship to your personal story changes over time. It's not fixed. It's so that's always really interesting to us.
Right, and especially in the case of Khalif, he was just 16 when he was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you hoping Voice of Witness goes in the future? Again, 10 years, you've got 14 books on such a wide array of issues. Your latest book is the book about Palestine. Right? Is that the latest one? Palestine Speaks. And again, it took the editors 4 years to complete, 250 hours of interviews, 3 months of fact-checking.
Yep.
What's been the response to this book? Because in the book about the 10 years of amplifying unheard voices, Dave Eggers writes that it required the courage to publish and stand behind the book, a book that strikes to the heart of issues about which there are few neutral feelings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he said it right there. This is a subject that that most people have strong feelings about. It's very, for a lot of people, it's emotionally charged, and it's really hard to, I think, check your opinions at the door when you're approaching some certain stories. And I think that's true for people who have certain views on immigration, who have certain views on whether people who've broken the law and in prison deserve a platform at all. So I think that we didn't want to be, we were very curious. Every book that we undertake is based on a genuine curiosity and humility towards certain subject, and we didn't want to bring any of our own presumptions to this project, and we also didn't want to be disingenuous about how this book might resonate or not with some people. So one thing that we did with this book, and that we do with many of our books, is that we, once we have a draft, a manuscript that we feel is fairly close to done, we'll share it with a close circle of readers who actually have different relationships to the issue and the subject at hand, and because we do realize that we've been spending a lot of time on these stories, and that when you're in the weeds, it's hard to be objective. And so we ask for feedback. You know, are there any voices that you think we've left out? Do you think it's not necessarily comprehensive? That's not our goal. But do you think it presents a holistic impression of what this this book purports to be about? And but the response overall has been really positive, and we at events, people who've written in we've had one or two letters perhaps out of all of that, but overwhelmingly people have been really glad that we've actually ventured into this territory, no pun intended, and and actually asked the question, well, what's daily life like for someone who's living under occupation?
And I think just to add on a little bit to what Mimi was saying, our process for the curriculum was very similar, and we worked with a lot of local teachers and got a lot of advice, and the first lesson in the whole curriculum for Palestine Speaks is related to, like, who am I and what am I bringing to these stories in terms of my own personal identity.
And again, that book is Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation, the latest book from Voice of Witness as it celebrates 10 years with 14 books. And we have an email from Jane who says, I think Voice of Witness would make a great radio series with people reading their own narrations. If you do that, please contact us. I think that would be fantastic. Mimi Locke is co-founder of Voice of Witness. Cliff Mayotte is Education Program Director of Voice of Witness. And Peter Orner is working on his third Voice of Witness book on post-earthquake Haiti. Peter, Cliff, and Mimi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How has colonialism shaped present-day Sudan? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with award-winning documentarian Hubert Sauper about his latest film, We Come as Friends. Sauper traveled to Sudan to document the birth of South Sudan, which declared its independence in 2011. The film takes an in-depth look at the effects of colonialism, globalization, and corruption, and why South Sudan has been mired in a perpetual state of war. Join us on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.